This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
So hello, dear listeners. Welcome to this very special episode of Urban Political Podcast, where we are going to discuss two outstanding books that have come out in the recent years, which allow us to better see and engage with the extremely troubled and violent reality that we are currently living through amidst endless wars, authoritarianism, neocolonialism. Millions are being displaced, and there's a pervasive uncertainty that is gripping millions more, whether it be in the never-ending genocide in Gaza, the needless war on the Iranian people, or the war on refugees and migrants on the streets of cities in the US, or even on minorities in India. Amidst the remaking of the world through what some have described neo-illiberalism, the very facade of humanitarianism, of what constitutes as being human, is falling apart. In today's episode, we have brought together the authors of two books into conversation that allow us to better engage with these issues. Together with the authors Nifrati Taidar and Anuradha Iyer Siddiqui, we'll be discussing the books Remaindered Live and Architectures of Migration, the Dadaab Refugee Camps and Humanitarian Settlement, respectively, in a cross-cutting dialogue with the authors. So welcome to the episode, Nifrati and Anu. It would be lovely if we could briefly introduce yourselves to the listeners. Maybe we can begin with Nifrati.
Thank you, Nitin, and thank you for the invitation to be on this podcast. My name is Nifrati Taidar. I am a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies, teaching at Barnard College. I was born in the Philippines on the western coast of the northern Luzon. And I moved to the city for college, and I moved to the U.S. For graduate school. I mentioned my life because it was also during a period of dictatorship, and that has consequently shaped quite a lot of my understanding of the world, the perspective I bring to the world. I'm also the author of several books. Remaindered Life is the last one. And I run an independent library in the Philippines, in the north.
Thank you, Nitin, and thank you, Nefertiti. It's really an honor for me to be here with two of my favorite people. I am also a professor at Barnard College. I was born in Chennai in India, which was called Madras at the time that I was born there. I've lived between India and the United States for most of my life. I've lived all over the world, but these are the two main places I've lived. Part of that is because I'm a descendant of migrants who were forced to move for various reasons. So I think the issues that we'll talk about today have been both very personal for me, but also they have been part of a long kind of professional journey in understanding my own discipline of art history and architectural history, which is sort of formed as a colonial discipline, and trying to also understand how those of us who are most impacted by built environments that were made by others, let's say, have tried to sort of decolonize the narratives of these histories.
Thanks, Nifrati. Thanks, Anu. Thanks for being part of this podcast, and thanks for sharing your work today. I wanted to start with an opening question to each of you. So how did concepts of remaindered life and architecture of migration emerge in your work? When did you start thinking of these concepts, these ideas? How do these concepts allow us to see what we're living through at the moment better? Maybe we can start with Nifrati again.
Thanks, Nitin. If I think about where it emerged, I feel like I have to say first that after I wrote it, I retrospectively realized that it was really the third in a trilogy. Was the last of the trilogy that I had written. And if I may, I just wanted to say that the genealogy of it, you know, my first book was called Fantasy Production, Sexual Economies and Other Philippine Consequences of the New World Order. And that was an attempt to grapple really with the as I mentioned, the dictatorship that I grew up under and its aftermath.
And it was also an attempt to think about globalization. But there, I was very much concerned with the organizing concepts and codes of political economy and what their consequences were for the lived lives of people, particularly what I saw as the state-sponsored sex economy, prostitution economy that had been bolstered by the dictatorship. So having done that, the second book, you know, wanted to focus more on historical experiences, not just the codes and protocols organizing our lives, but, you know, historical experience as processes that were shaped, but were also shaping social movements. And there I undertook a study of social movements, feminists, urban activists, and revolutionary movements. But there I saw what the pursuit of proper political subjects or proper political subjective ideals in these political movements eschewed because of their tethering to certain modern ideals of political subjectivity. And so in some ways, I was urged to look for these other experiences that that acted as part of the very forces of change that movements drew on, but nevertheless also exceeded those movements, that they subsequently got captured or subsumed by forces of globalization. So that was what the second book was about. So you can already hear here manifest in the title of that book, which was called Things Fall Away. You can already hear the emergence of this concept of remaindered life, you know, the stirrings of that concept in terms of this subalternization of social experiences here by modern political ideals, even within political movements, right? And not just by states and capital, that it was these norms of the way that we understand politics that was subalternizing these social experiences. But what was equally important for me is how I saw not just the foreclosure of these social experiences, but actually their persistence of these social experiences, their mutation, and what I saw is their role in these large scale transformations. So that these were historical experiences that were, in retrospectively, remaindered and yet had a historical force that then we misrecognize because we attribute much of these historical transformations to the big forces that we habitually credit transformation with, you know, imperial states, post-colonial governments, global capital. These were, as a feminist, we recognize very much the big agents of world historical change. So the emergence of the concept of remaindered life comes out of that project of looking for these historical experiences that emerge that exceeded some of these political ideals. But I have to say that it also emerged out of, at that point, my grappling with the global war on terror that had just launched shortly after the beginning of the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York in 2001. And that, if we all remember, that blitzkrieg shock and awe bombing of Afghanistan in the wake of 9/11. For decades, I was grappling with that at the same time that I was grappling with the rise of finance and its outsized role in determining capitalist life, and not just capitalist life, but just the normative conducting of everyday life. So these two forces, war and finance, was what I was grappling with that created what I saw and what you mentioned in your opening remarks as this massive disposability of people and entire life worlds that war and finance produce, and that I was witnessing across these decades of the opening of the first the 21st century. So remaindered life is my effort to grapple with this massive disposability. It also emerged, but more attuned to the dynamics of value production than in my previous work, because I also saw that as rising to the forefront of what I saw as a new global political economy of life, where life has become the object, the raw material, the fuel, the medium of value production, and the accumulation of capitalist wealth. So in some ways you can say the book
the book of Remaindered Life, and the concept is an attempt to think about what falls away, if you will, from a situation in which capital seeks to subsume every moment and modality of living by valuing some forms of life and wasting others. What falls away is what I understand to be the excess of social reproduction, the ways that communities that are designated for disposability, what Anu writes about, which are refugees, migrant workers, you know, all of these communities that are designated for disposability. And for me, it's whether they're disposable in the sense of being at the disposition of others in forms of servitude, or absolutely disposable or absolutely expendable, as most evident in these contexts of outright genocidal war. That is where the concept of remaindered life emerges out of.
Thanks, Nefrati. Thanks for sharing, taking us back and also contextualizing it within your larger body of work and the thinking that you've been doing. Anu, I would like to invite you perhaps next to share the same about architecture of migration.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate, Nefrati, the way you laid out the arc of these three books. I was thinking as you were talking that I've been working on architecture of migration for, I think, 15 years. So at that pace, I don't know if I'll ever write three books. But but there are certainly maybe three books in this book. But what I wanted to kind of start with is to say that architecture of migration, the title, was very carefully crafted concept for this book. And you know, it's used really very with regard to the historically specific referent of Dadaab, the architecture of Dadaab, Kenya, and the settlements that were made there by Somalis and other Africans who had for generations migrated within this land, across this land. And they even settled this land in various ways in migratory modes. And in more recent history have been migrants and have been refugees. And these settlements were also made by aid workers who themselves are migrants mostly from the global north or from other parts of Kenya. You know, they're brought into this region through a humanitarian regime. So together, these groups of people effected what I call in the book humanitarian settlement, which is an oxymoron, because emergency settlement in the context of humanitarian crisis is regularly understood as temporary. It has no history, it has no future, it only has this immediate present. But in Dadaab, I think what we see are the logics of a permanent temporary, and also the material and historical forces of settlement. And in a way, it provides an object lesson. It provides an object lesson exactly of what you've just described, Nefertiti, of this thing that we've been told to understand as remaindered. And yet you see that the forces of history are acting in a very different way. But maybe I'll talk about how I came to the book through the book builds on a few major arguments, and I think each of these will say a little bit about my own way in. You know, my first way in really is that, like Nefertiti's book, this book is attempting to make an intervention in the realm of the social and the political, but this book is also really intervening in the realm of the aesthetic. And that has been very important to me. And I mean aesthetic in three ways, you know, in a very conventional way in reference to beauty, also in terms of aesthesis or in reference to the sensible, but also in the philosophical reading of aesthetics. So at the core of architecture of migration, I'm really demanding that we look closely at architecture. I talk about architecture in many ways in the book, primarily as an ecology rather than as an urban form, but certainly as a craft or a gesture of visual rhetoric, a formal object, you know, something even approaching a monument. I would even, you know, a refugee camp, of course, could be understood as something in the margins, or a remainder in the very ways that Nefertiti is talking about, or the nation state system. But I do think that I've asked us to think about it precisely in terms of architectural form, as the centering of not only architectural form, but something like architectural symbolism. So that kind of aesthetic orientation is one thing that, and that comes from my own training as an artist, as an architect, as an art historian, as an architectural historian. The second thrust, though, I spoke about this for a second at the beginning, is about migration, and particularly migration as a method, not migration as a historical subject. I'm actually really interested in thinking with migration and what migration allows us to think about. And if we start to think about migration and architecture together, we see a real paradox, because we're made to think of architecture as something fixed, as predicated on fixity. Its history, its architectural history, is predicated on documents from landed archives. And I'm asking us to look at something like a migrant archive. But the third thing, and this is the maybe most personal way I came into this work, the third kind of orientation of the book is that what it really takes seriously are traditions of Black consciousness and Black planetary thought. In this book, I really braid together the work of intellectuals and makers for whom global Black thought and quite situated African worlds are home. And I think that quite literally this thinking comes from my own parents and the causes that they believed in and fought for. When my father first came to the United States, he found himself thrust into the Jim Crow world of the United States and occupying a very strange position within it, maybe occupying both sides of a divide. These are anti-apartheid activists that I was raised by. So I have thought in this book and written with African people living through forced displacement, with Somali intellectuals building on long intergenerational oral, material, cultural, and academic traditions, and also artists, architects, historians who study everything from ancient interlocking cave systems that cross the African continent, and also people who theorize, you know, it's the relational water bodies of Africa from rivers to oceans to subterranean aquifers. So I've read with Steve Biko, Abdi Latif Abdallah, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, Sylvia Tamale, Yvonne Adhiambo Owuor, and even Saidiya Hartman, to really think about Black consciousness. And I think that that is what impregnates these pages, and it's been my home base, and it's really been the warp and weft of architecture of migration.
Thank you, Anu. Anu, I had a question. I mean, at some point in the book, you talk about how the humanitarian present is also perhaps a refraction of this colonial history of land. So you talk about how Dadaab emerges as a contingent territory, as you call it, which is nestled as a ghost space and a contested territory on the dividing line between British Kenya and Italian Somaliland. And then how this sort of, like, you know, history doesn't just go away, it sort of it's refracted in this sort of humanitarian present. So I mean, there's also interesting methodological maneuver, as I see it, in the way how you sort of also position architecture as a way to see territory and land history as well. I wanted to maybe hear a little bit more about that, if I may.
Yeah, thank you. There's a couple of points I'd like to make. And I think, you know, the book delves into pre-colonial, colonial history, and also post-colonial history, if you want to think of it like in a periodized way. And I think it's important to me to say that, because I think that we're taught to look at humanitarian environments, or rather not look at them, by assuming that we know their history already, or we know where which regimes of history they might fit into. And I think one of the things I really wanted to do was push against that and say that, no, this place that we're taught to see as a refugee camp is actually holding long, multiple regimes of history, first of all, but also a very long history. And that is a history of negotiations over territory and contestations also. But some of what you've pointed to, I, you know, found through a lot of archival research and a lot of like oral history research, really found the ways in which this strange space where these refugee camps are located today happens to have a very long history of like many iterations of being a contested territory under different political regimes. One of the political regimes I'd like to point to, and maybe I'll take small issue with one small thing that Neferti just said. I believe that if we want to think about the global war on terror, we could very well go back to 1991 as a remnant of like the day that the camps at Dadaab were instituted. I would say that this war on terror that we are still dealing with today predates the 21st century, at least by that little bit. And, you know, we can look to the collapse of the Soviet Union and other things and what the ways that that was taking place in Africa. But Dadaab itself and the ways that the camps got turned into, you know, an apartheid space effectively has a lot to do with the US-led global war on terror. And it has to do with creating an iteration of the security state in East Africa. That's maybe one iteration of, I think, this long history of a way in which a certain territory is constructed as an emergency territory. Dadaab, as the refugee camp, happens to be the latest iteration of that. And I think that looking at these other iterations in the past, I look at what we could call quote-unquote humanitarian environments for liberated slaves in the 19th century. I look at other kinds of ways in which that territory was constructed there in East Africa. One of the things that I think is important to note about territory, and particularly, this is what I think is particularly evident in this territory, is that I think a territory is slightly different when it is built on the foundation of migration and people who settle a place through migrating across it. One of the really unusual things that happened in the 1960s when all these African countries were decolonizing, in the Organization of African Unity meetings, while effectively the European borders of Africa were eventually adopted for the new states, one state that was vehemently arguing for getting rid of all borders was Somalia. And the Somalis, in a sense, wanted to have no borders across the entire continent, but this was particularly important to them in East Africa. They thought of most of East Africa as a place that was their home. I'm putting all of this quite simply. It's obviously more complicated than this, but I think something about that really struck me, that to be people who migrate as the sort of fundamental life way, one of these kind of fundamental life worlds that I think is being erased, is to be working against the broader global demand for settlement, sedentarization of people. This 1960s question was a big question for me. Another big question, as someone who did come of age, you know, during the anti-apartheid movement and in the 90s, we grew up hearing this word failed state, failed state, failed state. And I always thought, what is it that these Somalis have actually failed at? What I've learned is that what they failed at was participating in this global capitalistic regime. And they failed at making themselves into territory in the ways that, you know, the other powers wanted them to. So to me, these were also ways that, you know, many of the things that Remaindered Life writes about, that Neferti writes about, these were things that suddenly kind of crystallized for me as I read that book. Because I do think that this is a fundamental way in which an entire state, in this case, has been remaindered, because it wasn't behaving according to the order that had been laid out for it. We see the you know, the afterlife of that in something like a refugee camp. But I suppose I just want to say that, you know, in this case, this is much more than a refugee camp. It is an actual form of archival evidence of this moment that we've found ourselves in.
Thanks, Anu. Thanks for that. Nefertiti, there's something that really stuck with me while I was reading, especially the introduction of your book, how you sort of position this triad of value, waste, and remainder as a thing that prefigures the book at different scales, as you write about in the introduction. And I was thinking about, you know, this other triad that's been quite important for many of us, which is Vinay Advani's triad of waste, value, and commons. And I think he's making some similar arguments, but and I'm not sort of like asking to go into that, but a lot of people writing about waste have always thought about, you know, how these practices of salvage come into, you know, again, back into capitalism. So, you know, Anand Singh's work or Vinay Advani's work. So what does remainder illustrate for us? So what does it allow us to see?
Thanks for that, Nitin. I mean, Vinay and I have been in conversation for a very long time. And I very much rely on, I both rely on and I'm in conversation with the waste value dialectic that he elaborates. And like Vinay, I see a much longer, and here I will have to actually say something, Anu, about the colonial genealogy of the war on terror, which I do write about. You know, I mean, part of the reason that I said its launch was obviously in the first 21st century because it was its declared launch as the name Global War on Terror. But certainly we could date it to 1991 and much longer, but it was my way of thinking about the emergence of the concept itself, remaindered life, during that time from 2000 to the current moment. And I'm going to get to your question, Nitin, as a way of thinking about what remaindered life brings, which is both a longer genealogy, genealogical timeline for these logics, codes, and protocols of capitalist value making, because it's also a theory about imperialism and the role of imperial war, particularly in relationship to what we understand to be formal capitalism, right? The notion of waste and value dialectic is very much contained within, as I understand it, okay, within a capitalist framework. But what I was concerned with in thinking about imperialism is that active wars of dispossession, you know, continuous all throughout these centuries, and how they punctuate and they support the capital relation, which is one of exploitation. And that's where remaindered life emerges out of those places of that are in the imperial relation is a very paradoxical relation, as Claude Mahissou talks about it, because it is one which destroys and preserves. It destroys and preserves because you require that the seemingly outside spheres of capitalism to generate modes of reproduction that are unaccounted for and certainly valued at nothing for the capital labor relation, which is remunerated with wages and formally exploitative, right? But this space of imperial war is seemingly outside of that, even though the argument, of course, is that it's not. So if that's the space for seeing and understanding, and remember, for me, remaindered life is also heuristic. It is not an object. It is not just something that we find. It is a method for interpreting and for understanding. It is a form of attention. That's what I was talking about. But it's an attention shaped by this waste value dialectic of seeing as more and more things become valued even out of waste. You sometimes lose perspective of like, well, where is the outside? Even if these lives are being genocided right now, like how are they and values being created? Then where is the leftover, right? And there I don't so much find commons, but it's related to commons. I find capacities, the life capacities of people that are cooperative and shared. And so perhaps that is in conversation with the idea of the commons. Although commons is a theoretically very tricky. It's been critiqued by indigenous theorists because of its genealogy to the idea of a commons, which is, again, well within the colonial framework
of what is common to all, and is still seen in forms of possession, right, in forms of property. And to think completely outside of that, we would have to have other words for it. So remaindered life is a placeholder for thinking for these capacities, these modes of living that are inherited, improvised, invented. So it is, it's also not just standing there for us to discover, because it's it behooves us as analysts to think about what that would mean in terms of our capacity to write it, rather than to objectify it, to make it another object that then we can valorize, or to make it into a procedure so that we can sell our theory. Or, you know, it's very difficult to evade this valorizing impulse, but it is more an invitation for a certain kind of regard that we have already in us, I think, if we participate. I do believe if you are the descendants of the colonized, you bear with you things that have not been entirely destroyed, but you have capacities that you have inherited as just the form of your shared life making. So there's a very long timeline for that, equally as long as colonialism, and longer than that. Anu mentioned pre-colonial. I do draw on some work that mentions pre-colonial practices, not to say that nothing has changed, but that there are inheritances that we bring forward and create with in the present. And that's where also I think that my conversation with a whole variety of scholars, indigenous, feminist, post-colonial, Black, feminist, queer, and trans folks are, because of their focus on all of these other kinds of capacities that people bear under conditions of great duress and survival that don't come from blank slates. They're not blank slates. Even if they are invented, they are invented in shared life, and therefore they do have a longer timeline than a capitalist one of invention.
Nefertiti, that was really interesting. And I wanted to maybe pose this question to both of you, which is regarding political imaginaries, which is something that we're very interested in here at the Urban Political Podcast. So what kind of political imaginaries emerge when we theorize from remaindered life and architecture of migration, both as heuristic and as concepts, right? Like, so could you perhaps, maybe Nefertiti, could you talk about it first? And of course, you know each other's work as well. So, I mean, as usual, you could also always talk through each other's ideas as well.
Maybe I should start with a few ideas from Anu that I feel, you know, my talking about shared life, you know, is very much in the spirit of her talking, for example, about insurgent domesticities and ways of thinking about homemaking as forms of architecture, that they are building capacities that people that bring with them in these contingent spaces. As I mentioned, the longer timelines, I appreciated these, the way that Anu, when she thinks about migration, she's thinking about migratory ways of being that emerges as migratory because of this drive to sedentarization, and partition. You know, we see them as exceeding that, but these territories that are laid down by colonial orders, and yet they have longer histories as ways of being for whole communities. Therefore, these ways of being and ways of living against moralized forms of settlement are similar to what, or at least in resonant to me in thinking about these capacities and practices of social life that I mentioned. So when we begin to think like this, then we're able to see other ways of organizing life that don't depend on the nation state, that don't depend on these borders, and that don't depend on the policing and the territorialization that wars very much depend on, right? It opens up the imagination of how we could recraft, to use the words of architecture, recraft other ways of living together. And I would say that the forms of making homes, for example, don't depend on, again, a settlement imaginary. Some of the homes and kinship networks and social cooperative networks that I talk about in my book with migrant workers really take place across continents, certainly helped by some of these technologies, but you could also say the reverse, that these practices and the need to stay connected and attachments are also what fueled the development of these technologies. So you start to begin to see that these creative capacities of living on the part of people drive the very technologies of their predation, the technologies of their subsumption under capitalism, but also exceed them. So you see them as an active force of a force for remaking life more broadly, severed from the institutions of their capture and the institutions of their predation. You see them in their own right as bearing the not future possibilities, but political imaginaries in the current moment that are so devalued as to be rendered worth nothing and in fact actively destroyed, precisely because they present the possibility of another way of living that could proliferate. Just to close this, it's like Palestinian sumud, Palestinian survival. All the ways that Palestine survived this genocide are so threatening because they can't rely on the very same kinds of protocols necessarily of life worth living under capitalism. What's a good life under capitalism? Because they're already completely prohibited from living under those terms, given the situation of settler colonialism. And therefore, they're threatening because they do bear political imaginaries that in other spaces, you know, largely for me, it is Philippine forms of survival under similar conditions of war, that these political imaginaries can be in conversation with each other, not to replicate each other, but in other kinds of exchange and other kinds of, you know, mutual building.
Thanks, Nefertiti. Anu, would you like to come in?
You've said a lot of things there, Nefertiti, and I have to say I'm actually still chewing on a couple of things you had said earlier. I mean, one of the things I started to really think about in this work on Dadaab specifically, but really thinking about what is an architecture of migration, what are these territories, you know, that in a way the humanitarian environment is kind of incidental. The nation state territory to me is sort of incidental because I think I too was also oriented toward thinking beyond all that. You know, what did come before? I love this notion of capacities as a way to start to think about something that we might think of as a shared experience and resource. You said two things earlier that to me have been maybe a problem I've been grappling with. One is, you know, even talking about something like the global war on terror, what I think is very interesting and explosive about the way you've written about it, and also in certain ways about the way I've written about it, is the way that it, what I think we're both doing is demanding that these things didn't start on a certain date. We're demanding a kind of acknowledgement of the colonial and imperial, like long-standing history of these ways of making life into something that, as you write, becomes so parsed that, you know, and yet we still have to call it life. We're not able to think of it as lifelessness. Like we still have to think that this is life, but in the way that I've written about it, I think of it as so partitioned that at some point it really quite literally takes the taste out of the mouth. It's not a life in the end, but yet this is what life is, and life is being used as the primary thing from which to extract, to kind of continue, you know, all the things that you were just saying. To me, the way that maybe this comes from my disciplinary orientation, to me that turns me to a question of then how do we write the history of this? How do we write its past? How do we write about its kind of long-standing existence? And yet, how do we do that with our feet standing on the ground in the present? Because I think we must write those pasts while acknowledging the politics of the present. And that, to me, is why it's like interesting to unpack a refugee camp in the present to think about a long past, or even to unpack something like the global war on terror as a war to be human. I feel like that is a really powerful move, because it demands that we liberate ourselves from, as many people have written, like, one of the colonizers don't only colonize space, they colonize time, and they also colonize our ability to understand time. I feel like it really liberates us from the chokehold of this temporal reality that we think we're part of. So that was a big part of what I was actually trying to do in this book. But honestly, I learned quite a lot about that from your own articulations of this thing that you referred to from the first pages of your book as a war. I hadn't conceived of it in that way that I think is incredibly productive. For me, the war is like, how do I write a history using something, and how do I write architecture in a way that is pushing against what I'm told to think is architecture and what I'm told to think is history. But I hadn't conceived of it as a war, I think, until I really had been in conversation with you. And Nefertiti and I have been in conversation for many years. We've been part of this working group called Insurgent Domesticities. One of the things that unlocked for me when I first read your book many years ago, when it first came out, was that, you know, you're precisely not writing about remainders. That's not the right way to talk about your book. You're actually writing about life. You're such a precise writer, but this using remaindered as an adjective, it makes it into a force that has its own agents who are committing the remaindering. And I think this is the force, you know, from the outset of your book that you're declaring war on. And to me, that declaration of war that you make in the book, that is a political imaginary. I have made a call for peace in my book. Peace for me comes only with justice. But I do think that I've also said that this book that I'm writing is a call for peace. I interviewed hundreds of mothers for this book who had fled and took whatever children remained in the house because their older boys had been kidnapped so that they could be conscripted to be fighters in a war. And I think I, you know, had a 3-year-old son at the time, so I think many things about it were very personal for me, or I just felt a little like, if we can't see ourselves in these actions, if we can't, I mean, especially I'm a citizen of the United States, so I think I feel a personal sense of responsibility whenever I study these things. But I was really seeing that these ways of conditioning life, so that life for some looks like this, and it can only look like this. That to me is maybe the war that I'm in. So writing that differently to me was also a way of starting to think about a political imaginary of what would be a different life. I don't know if peace is the right word in the end. I don't know that this is something that even exists or is a term that we should use. But I think in my own way, I want to call for it just because I think that we need to be calling for something. I wanted to say one, you know, other thing about this, the way I read your book, another kind of crucial way, just you were talking about the homemaking that I write about. And I think a lot about making home quite literally through architecture, and also homemaking and these other ways that we do that are more about an imaginary, creating a life beyond, as many of these mothers did for their children. I don't mean to particularly valorize the mother or anything like that. I think we can turn to many critiques of that as well. But I'm just using this as a concrete example because of the people I interviewed. I think of one of the thrusts of your book is around the ways that labor, and we can think of domestic labor, but there are many kinds of labor, and labor particularly as constitutive of capital, has undergone this transformation from the frame of the colonial, like this colonial humanism that you write about, in which that notion of labor, the labor capital relation was maybe born, in which reproductive labor was a supplement, as you write, and instead it becomes constitutive. And one of the moments that really struck me in this is that you start talking about how life is labor, meaning that life, which is, you know, the kind of central element of production, is the remainder. It is the thing that is remaindered. And I've appreciated that so much because it's a sort of demand to keep our eye on the enemy, keep an eye on who's doing the remaindering. And it's a kind of targeting of the real criminals. And for me, that formed a kind of shelter. It was the political imaginary that was created. And, you know, you've said in the book, in your book, that it's, you're not only talking about this opposition between the valuing and devaluing of human life, but it's also, your fight is also against this relentless and continuous parsing of that value and disposability relationship. That to me is what I have really identified with in thinking about what does it mean for a refugee to have to undergo a self-partitioning simply in order to be recognized? What does it mean to be in a refugee camp that is the result of a partition of land that is like existing because of this kind of continuous parsing and partitioning? Those to me are fights we can actually take up. I mean, again, I don't know that peace will be the end of it. But to me, peace is a target to set my sights on while we do this work of struggling and fighting against this parsing and partitioning. That's a political imaginary, if I can think of one.
I think that's a very beautiful horizon as well, which, I mean, it's sometimes unattainable, but definitely an interesting horizon to have one. I must say that, you know, both your books have been very useful for me, especially because I work in very troubled contexts, both in India and in Europe, where, you know, authoritarian past and authoritarian present sort of, you know, condition this palimpsest on which I'm often studying a very present time. But this sort of idea of remaindered life and architecture of migration has always allowed me to, you know, sort of see this palimpsest of territory differently. So I just wanted to maybe pose a question to both of you. As you unpack this palimpsest of space-time, of colonizations, rationalizations, and warfare, while acknowledging the present, how do you think of inhabitation otherwise through the vocabularies and concepts that you introduce in your book? So in terms of life-making, in terms of capacities, and what you call also generative accommodation in the book. So maybe we could start with Anu this time.
I think I want to turn back to kind of a demand for a kind of aesthetic accountability. I think it's been so important to me to think about inhabitation not only as a social thing, also not only as a political thing. I think I have really believed that there can be no political without the aesthetic. I think that's something I've followed, you know, down a very deep rabbit hole in my work and in my life. You know, something unlocked for me in Dadaab itself, in seeing buildings that are literally growing out of the ground and that are woven together from branches of plants that are growing right out of the ground. They have been trained lovingly by someone's hands. You can see family stories woven into some of the cladding on some of these buildings. There's very particular weaves that are only known by certain people. This kind of detail, I think, aesthetic detail, and, you know, that grows out of long, long generations of the passing down of knowledge of how to make something. And also, this will sound very exoticizing, but just as objects, these were quite beautiful environments. In my mind, I'd never seen environments like this. And I think I was struck just like being in the presence of a place like this, to witness that and to walk through those streets and be part of that, to me, taught me something. One of the ways I describe this environment is as, you know, I describe the makers of Dadaab as the avant-garde. And I do think in our ecological horizon, this is the avant-garde. These are people who know how to live in, let's say, the roughest conditions. These are people who have literally handmade their inhabitations. And so I don't know, actually, that I would call this inhabitation otherwise. I think I would just call this inhabitation. But I think that we are now in this moment, not to kind of have a crisis umbrella around this conversation, but I do think that this is what inhabitation must be. And we must take, you know, some lessons from the knowledge that is expressed in this kind of inhabitation. For me, the insurgent domesticity of this is the knowledge of how to make not just the shelter, but the domesticity of this, to have the intimacy of the home, the ways of creating, protecting ourselves, caring for ourselves through something like built shelter. These are things that I still try to think about a lot, but what I've tried not to lose is the idea that these weren't just put up ad hoc, and they certainly weren't put up ad hoc by nation states or NGOs. They were handcrafted by people who learned that from their grandmothers and their great grandmothers, and that went, you know, that goes on for a very long time. So again, as I think about, like, how do we write histories? How do we tell ourselves our own stories about our pasts? To me, these are the things to include in these stories. What we made and how we made them beautiful.
Thanks, Anu. That was very, very touching. I just wanted to add very quickly something here. I was yesterday, I was giving a tour through a photographic exhibition at the Museum for Design in Zurich. And there's one photograph that especially touched me, and it speaks to, Anu, what you just talked about. Aesthesis and, you know, kind of the power of aesthetics in also visibilizing sometimes, if not inhabitation otherwise, but these sort of, you know, very subaltern forms of inhabitation, which are not just alternatives, but they are futurities in a way. I was going through this image by this photographer called Gideon Mendel, and he does photography on climate change and people living with climate change. And there was a very beautiful image from someone from Sindh, the Sindh province in Pakistan, close to Karachi, where, you know, so since a few years, there's a cycle of floods. It was a beautifully composed image with a person who's standing in his house during the floods. And what you see behind him is a scale of previous flood lines that have not been erased and that are part of the inhabitation itself. And it's something that you see, you know, in these scales that the state puts out close to rivers and other places about, you know, what are the flood lines, 100-year flood line or whatever. And then this person had this very beautifully integrated into the life history of the house itself. So that I just sort of sharing that just for the listeners before I pass it to Neferti. Neferti, would you like to come in as well, please?
Thanks, Nitin, and thanks, Anu, for that. You know, both your comments about war and aesthetics, because I feel this is where the real conversation is between our works. And you're right to say, you know, this question of inhabitation is a question about, you know, how do we live life? You know, how to, inhabitation isn't just space and shelter and so forth, but it's the mode, right? A mode of inhabitation, basically a way of life, mode of living. And that is the question that is posed precisely by the fact of something like this abstraction of life is the object of capitalist valorization. And I say this early on in the book, that it poses the question of what kind of life? What kind of life are we after? And it points us into the direction of other forms of, you know, you talk about homemaking, and yes, I talk about life making, other forms of life making. And here, the question of life or vitality exceeds
that of what I say is capitalism's own vitalism, where it thinks that it understands what life is and makes money and value out of life. But there's a vitalism that exceeds both our sense of organic life, the biological life, the life that we essentialize in the same scientific ways as we have made distinctions between the living and the dead, between the living and the inanimate, between objects and subjects, that this vitality also doesn't necessarily happen simply like inside of organic entities, but really even what passes across, you know, these, what I talk about as vibrations across existences and relations. It does bring up the question of the aesthetic, which I have written quite a lot about in the book itself. You know, in the book, I do not only write about artworks, especially artworks that are in conversation in the wake of the age of decolonization, that are allowing us to attend to what I see also as forms of remaindered life in these filmmakers, artists, etc. But the remaindered life, I also claim, is a political aesthetic heuristic. And by this, I do not actually mean the beautiful in this case, because one of the things that I talk about is the aesthetics of war, the aesthetics of the killing of people in the war on drugs, the Duterte's war on drugs, the killing all of these people as scum, that there is an implied aesthetics of disgust. And those who supported Duterte's war also were for life. They were for revaluing Filipino life. And there was an aesthetics, a sensorial enjoyment, both to the killing and to redeeming the life that they felt was being cast away by these drug addicts. In response to that, I see so many of the ways that people's forms of survival and people's forms of fighting back. Notice that even though I talk about war, I'm talking about what it means for the becoming human to live in a time of war. That's my main object, is living in a time of war. Not that we are in a war, for sure. And I would also be anti-war in the sense of stopping existing wars declared by these military-industrial complexes. But I do see that war happening quite across, you know, soft wars across the whole social sphere in very small scales. And that war is there. And therefore, what are the aesthetics of remaindered life in this time of war? The ways that people are able to steal enjoyments. And I write a lot about splendor, about these fleeting moments of almost gratuitous living in spite of that, that there is other kinds of aesthetics. I'm not normative about it. There are many kinds of aesthetics in these places of complete degradation. And here I go to the slum dwellers who are being targeted by the Duterte war machine, to see that the drug addicts themselves and their capacities and their enjoyments are not necessarily inspiring ideals for us, but they do give us pause for what we aestheticize as really part of the life that is still worth living. And I try to upend that by thinking about these other forms of aesthetics, these other kinds of moments and sensorial pleasures that can't easily be converted into value, even political value. Because the book that I wrote before, the political value was as much of the problem as capitalist value. And that, you know, creating political value and degrading all of these other ways of living in favor of an understanding of what was politically valuable was really, to me, what happened with the war on drugs, that they were not politically valuable subjects. No political movement wanted to take them up. There were some, of course, there were some political movements, but they weren't readily taken up precisely because they exceeded the norms, the ideals, the subjects of what is a life worth living and life worth fighting for, and therefore also like creating aesthetic pleasures out of. Because one of the things I critique is, you know, some of the institutions that also make aesthetic value out of waste. you don't only make capitalist value out of waste, you make aesthetic value out of waste. And I think Anu, in some ways, also touches upon this on the in the chapter on design, the way that it's paradoxically, you know, all of these infrastructures created by humanitarian practices also, you know, commodify the aesthetics of their own life-saving, you know, emergency apparatuses. So to me, the forms of inhabitation that we not necessarily otherwise, I suppose, well, maybe otherwise, has to be, you know, relentlessly against value formation. So you really have to think about what is life without value, not in this negative sense of therefore disposable, but what is living without value that has an aesthetics of abundance and pleasure and splendor for us, where it gives you more anyway, you know, because it's without value, and yet, you know, and that's the last chapter, and then yet you get some, and then some, you get more out of life. That, I think, is what at least these examples that I see in these spaces of remaindered life have led me to be instructed by, to be inspired by, not necessarily to emulate and to make normative for everybody else, but it's a form of regard, as I mentioned, that allows us to ask that question of what kind of life we want. And that is not to be answered by any single person, obviously. It can only be answered by communities. It can only be answered by those who are sharing the life that they want to define as theirs.
Thank you, Nefertiti. That was really, really, I mean, I'm out of words to even express how much I learned today in this podcast and talking with both of you. I think there's a lot to process here, but I think our listeners will definitely enjoy listening to what you just talked about, but also reading your book. So I would really encourage our listeners to read both these books, perhaps best together, because I think they speak a lot to each other. It's a must read, especially in our current times, which, as we said at the start of this episode, very, not just unprecedented, but very urgent and very encompassingly uncertain. Thanks a lot, both of you, for doing this and for taking the time and for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you. And a gratitude to both of you. And thank you, Anu, for writing your book. You know, I think you're right, Nitin, that the conversation is very, very close, and they would be very good companion books to read.
Yeah, thank you so much, Nitin, for making this space. And Nefertiti too, for all that not just what you've written, but all that you do.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website, urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter